Hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the New Mainstream podcast, where we explore the impact of multicultural consumers on marketing and media. I'm your host, Mario Carrasco, and co-founder of Think Now. Excited to introduce our guest today, Jessica Salinas, Chief Investment Officer at New Media Ventures. Welcome, Jessica.
Hi, Mario. Good to see you again. Good to
be here. Yeah, likewise. Now doing it virtually, we just, it feels like we just did LTX Quest, but now that was like, what, three or four months ago?
Yeah, like 3 or 4 months since we recorded. Yeah,
that was awesome. And that's what really prompted me, like, I need to reconnect and get you on the podcast. So I've known you for a while. I think when I first met, I was part of the first Stanford Latino cohort, which you were managing and, you know, really crucial part of that, which was awesome. And since then I've been following, you know, your career. You've had an amazing career. So for our listeners that don't know about your origin story, would love for you to share a little bit about how you came to be Chief Investment Officer.
The answer is, I don't know. I'm just kidding. The real answer. No, I mean, sometimes I look back and I'm like, how did I end up here? And, you know, I was just at the Tejano Tech Summit and in Houston this past weekend, and I was speaking at it. It was the first Tejano Tech Summit led by a friend of ours, Jesse Martinez. And I had the pleasure of speaking, you know, on a fireside chat. And the reason I bring it up is because I am from Houston, right? I was raised in Houston and my family was there. And this is the first time, you know, that my grandparents had seen me speak. And, you know,
Oh, I love that.
So they were present, and, you know, they understood maybe a portion of what I said because they speak only Spanish. So I threw in some, you know, Spanish words in there, but I think I bring that up because I think that's part of the origin story, right? I come from a large Mexican immigrant family who has really embedded a lot of the values that I feel like I still live by and who embody the spirit that I want to kind of embody myself in every aspect of my life, including professionally. And I'd just be remiss not to mention them as part of what motivates my work now, the community that I was born surrounded by. And it was a beautiful experience. And I was, you know, they don't quite understand what I do either.
Do people in your industry really understand though, right?
I don't think so. But I actually started my career in education. I graduated from Stanford University, first generation, you know, the story, and ended up in K-12 charter school education in East Palo Alto. I then went on to the Foundation for Hispanic Education, which works out of East San Jose. Both of these are in the Bay Area, and they're both like East Side communities, right? Which tend to have a lot of Black and Brown and Polynesian communities that live there and aren't as well resourced as their white counterparts. But I actually didn't quite love what I was doing, and I had the opportunity to go to an executive education program. So similar thread, but as I soon found out, very different for this initiative called the Stanford Latino Entrepreneurship Initiative. And I was brought in actually initially to be the community manager for, we had a co-working space and I was going to manage it, but we were a small team, which means that you actually end up doing everything. Yeah.
It's like a startup, right?
Exactly. It was a startup, and I didn't know going in that it was a startup. And there were three of us that were working on this big initiative, right, to scale Latino businesses. I went from community manager to actually co-authoring the first research report that came out of the Stanford Latino Entrepreneurship Initiative, which now is on its, I believe, fifth or sixth national report.
Historic.
That's amazing. The State of U.S. Latino Entrepreneurship. And I think, you know, looking back, it was meant to put numbers to a lot of the issues that I think we already knew were real, right? I don't think it was like necessarily for us, because I think if we grew up in this community, you know that there's lack of access to capital. You know that there are things that exist that make it difficult for Latinos to like scale their businesses. It felt like it was more, we needed some type of external validation for other people to believe us first, and then second, to want to allocate resources to the issues we knew were happening. And so I'm really proud that I was able to be part of that research initiative, and that, you know, my name is on that report.
I think to your point, yeah, too, like I like thinking about that report and actually going through the program, I think you're right. Like, as a Latino entrepreneur, I kind of intuitively knew the barriers, but yeah, there was something about the numbers and really just even the language around that helped me kind of accept my journey too, right? Like, I didn't necessarily know how to put it into words some of the barriers I faced, but when I saw that report and went through the program, I was, oh, that's why I don't know about some of these financial instruments or nomenclature and that. So it was helpful for me too, right? Like, even though I kind of knew that, to see it written out like that and experience that, I think was really helpful. So I just wanted to add to that.
No, I think that's exactly it. Like, it's almost like a moment, right? Where you're like, oh, that's what it is.
Right. Right. Exactly.
I've like, one, my experience is valid, and there are external like validators now for it, and I'm not alone, right? It's not, you know, necessarily something I'm doing wrong, like as an individual, this is a thing.
Exactly.
And there's
exactly
a lot of value. Yeah. Yeah. I think there's a lot of value to that. And I mean, since then, we have, I think, 5 reports now, 6 reports, probably. I know the last few were led by another amazing Latina, Dr. Marlene Orozco, who's also at Stanford with her. She's amazing. And she's done even more incredible work. But that was actually the basis for the what we call the post-accelerator program that you were a part of, where we had this, you know, data, we had these findings, and now we were able to build a program around it to really address what we had found. And to your point of, you know, there are so many things in that report that I clearly remember. And the one that always sticks out is, if Latino business owners had scaled their businesses at the same rate as their non-Latino counterparts during like a certain time period, I think it was 2012, it would have added $1.2 trillion to like the US economy, right? And you're like, wow. Like,
yeah.
If only we could, right, give the same amount of resources. And so that, I think that's what the program was really meant to catalyze, right? That support, it was meant to catalyze the capital support, but also like this network of Latino businesses supporting each other and bringing in allies and public and private institutions to like rally around the same community. And I think that was really special. And I was so happy, you know, you were part of the first cohort. We were hustling in the background, creating this with Stanford professors, really flying, what's that saying? I'm really bad at idioms. Flying the plane as we built it, building right. the plane as we flew it.
both work. I was amazed and it was great. So I couldn't tell that I was part of an experiment. So it was all good.
That's the best compliment. Tell we were doing something right. But that's actually where I first came in contact with venture capital. So as part of what we were doing, we were bringing in capital providers, right, at the end of the program to connect with all of the business owners that had gone through the program. There were about 75 to 80 each cohort. And, you know, I went in very naively. I wasn't part of this world prior to this. And so I was like, oh, yeah, I'll reach out to all these capital providers, and then, you know, we'll have conversations. And like very, very soon after that thought, I realized that it wasn't going to be that easy, actually, and that there were differences between like microloans and banks and venture capitalists, and that I couldn't just match a brick and mortar company to a, you know, microloan provider if they didn't have X, Y, and Z, or a venture capitalist if they didn't fit their thesis. And so here I was matching like hundreds of capital providers to these companies and having to really learn the industry as I was doing it. And I really found impact investing. I think I came in contact with someone who's now raised a huge, a really big fund, Marcos Gonzalez from Vamos Ventures. And, you know, we had hit him up. We knew he, you know, he was looking to allocate capital. And he was the first one that actually introduced me to the term impact investing. I didn't quite know what it was, but as I was interviewing and talking to people, he was one that mentioned that term, and I was like, what does that mean? And that led me to USC for my master's in social entrepreneurship. And I think you also went to USC.
Yeah, I think we did. Program, right? Yeah, yeah, entrepreneurship and innovation. Yeah,
yeah. Because I had so many questions. I didn't know if there were real business models that could exist that, especially under the capitalistic system that we live in, that could exist where profit was just as important as purpose and mission. And if they did exist, what did they look like? What policies guided them? What values? How did they, you know, I just had so many questions. And then on the other side, what were investors getting out of this if they were investing in these types of organizations? And so I went in with a lot of questions. And in one of the classes, which is a story for its own podcast, but in one of my classes, I met the CEO of Headspace. And he had been part of that class. He was speaking in that class and had been there for the first half. And I heard some of what a classmate and I had been talking about around how race and ethnicity played a role in business risk and the decisions we're able to make. And thus was a real business issue, right? That we should take into consideration.
This is something you presented and the CEO of Headspace saw that presentation.
I wouldn't call it a presentation as much as a conversation, a one-sided conversation with a professor who, you know, he was a white man, and he didn't quite understand why this classmate and I had continued class over class bringing up race and ethnicity as like a business factor, right? He thought it was deviating from the conversation. The class was around a blueprint for business ventures, right? Building a business. And he just couldn't comprehend why we thought it was a valid business factor, right? And I think he was like, at this point, it had been a few classes. We had been bringing it up, right? I was, you know, high off the Stanford Latino. I was like, no, it matters. I promise. Like, I have all of this data. And in that class, we were talking about access to capital, and that professor, he just wasn't very receptive to the comments that we were making. And he kept pushing back on certain points that we had data on around, you know, how we don't have the same access to VC capital. His pushback was, well, that, you know, that's a problem for all companies, startups. You know, most of them go to friends and family anyway for their first round. I'm like, great point. So let's talk about generational wealth.
Let's talk about the average household income by race.
Right, and like education and networks and how that all works under the United States, right? And globally. And how my family could give, you know, sure, I can go and ask them, but they'll give me $20 and I have to pay it back next week, right? Your family can give you, I mean, I don't want to speak for him, but, you know, I said like $500,000. And where does that leave us when we're trying to implement ideas, right? It doesn't mean that your idea is better, but you have more resources, right, to fail and take risks, et cetera, whereas I don't. And he just, again, like, was not receptive. And the CEO of Headspace at the time was sitting in on that discussion before his presentation. And for me, you know, I was about to leave because I was so, you know, heated. I was like,
did you know that he was there, the CEO of Headspace? Did you know he was there?
I knew that he was the speaker. He was like our case for the week.
Right.
And that was the model of the class, right? We had a case. That speaker would come in and talk about what he did in the scenario that was brought up in the case. But I didn't know what Headspace was, right? So at that point, I had no idea. I just knew that in that classroom was, again, another white man that this other white man professor was bringing in to teach a class of majority, at that point, people of color were in this class, about how to build a successful venture. And I was very like frustrated, and I was going to walk out, but I stayed in the class. And, you know, this guy comes up and I think he did a really good job at acknowledging what me and my classmate had said, right? I think he took time to acknowledge that he had never heard this being presented before. He had been talking to the class, I think he had said, for the past 4 years. This was the first time he heard of it, which speaks to privilege, right? And how he was, you know, listening and reflecting on his experience founding Headspace, and how they actually had relied on family and friends, right, to start up their venture, and how that money had actually allowed them to not raise VC money until they needed it for growth. And he did.
Wow.
I know. And so I think he did what we hoped the professor would do, which was acknowledge that this was legitimate and valid, right? Speaking of what we were talking about earlier, like that validation.
Yeah.
We're not crazy. We're experiencing this, and we know our experiences. We feel them, right? And so he did that portion. And after the class, you know, he had talked a lot about their philanthropic efforts, et cetera, and what they were working on at Headspace. And after the class, I went up to him, and I remember I like legitimately saying, and again, I didn't know who this man was, right? Other than he's the speaker of this at our class. And I was like, you know, you talked a good game. But I have questions for you. And he was like, oh yeah, like ask me the questions. So I asked him about the prison program that they had, and I asked him about how they were incorporating like family members. I have an incarcerated brother, how they were incorporating family members into like the content and into like the strategy for that. I asked him about how their talent pool looked, meaning, are you employing people of color? And, you know, he was like, let's have lunch. And so that's how we had lunch. The classmate and I both went, and that ended up turning into a job. So we were brought in to do partly philanthropic work and then partly lead their customer success. So be part of the founding B2B team, which I had no experience in, but I was like, I'll try it. And, I loved it. I think my win was that I started and advocated and won resources for the creation of the social impact team. So a legitimate like social impact team, and created the strategy for that alongside, you know, the colleague that came in with me. And I also built the foundation of the business to business team, like the B2B team, which is now a huge part of what Headspace is. So I'm really proud of that, but I was exhausted.
I want to take a minute to acknowledge, like, and specifically, so like just a little bit about our audience, like we have DE&I professionals and Fortune 500s, and then also kind of multicultural marketers. And I think one of the things that I love that about this story is that you were speaking your truth. And I think I talk to a lot of DE&I professionals that find that difficult, right? Or like, where do I start? Or how honest can I be? And I think I just love that you were just honest. There was no filter, right? When you were talking to the professor and the CEO happened to be there, and that got you a position that you're passionate about. I just think that's a great learning for those listening that are in DE&I and kind of feel that way.
Also, we'll say that there's a layer of ignorance is bliss there, right?
Yeah.
I had no idea what Headspace was. I didn't know their history. I knew, had this very limited amount of information, to the point where when I showed up to lunch, you know, he had said, I want to hear what y'all think, right? Me and my classmate. And so we showed up, like I showed up in an I am an immigrant shirt, right? From like forward.us. I was like, if he has to hear what I have to say, like, I'm going to tell you.
Yeah.
And so I felt like almost there was nothing to lose at that point, because we weren't looking to gain anything in the first place.
Right.
So there's that layer of like, ignorance is bliss.
No, yeah.
And but I do think that it has informed who I am now, in that because I went in being like unapologetically like myself, right? I felt like when I got there, I could be unapologetically myself, right? I could tell them, I have an incarcerated brother who is going through a trial right now. And that means that, you know, it's, for some people, it made them uncomfortable, right? But I could tell them, I need these days off because I have these court dates, that, and I am the provider for my family. And it made them uncomfortable, but it was my reality. And I never felt like I had to apologize or hide that aspect of me. Right. I think I wanted to also let them know there are different types of Latinos, and not everyone is going to fit your respectability politics. I think sometimes in the Latino community and the Black community and in white spaces, it's like, oh, we like a certain kind of Latino, right? The one that went to like Stanford and that speaks English in this way and that conforms to XYZ. And yes, I went to Stanford, but I am still very connected to my family and very connected to my culture. And that means so many things, right? That don't fit your norms of respectability or what it means to be like the right type of Latina. And I will not apologize for that, because it has made me who I am, and it's the life that I live, you know?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I mean, like, tying it to my experience, like, I don't think I showed my tattoos probably till 4 or 5 years ago, to be honest. And I've had them for a while, you know, but I just... Right. Took me a while to feel comfortable in that, you know?
And they're probably really cool.
I love them. I love them. Yeah.
So yeah, it has, I think, informed the way I navigate the workplace and the way I feel comfortable in a workplace. But it was also exhausting. I think I was one of the first, if not the first Latina that was hired in like a business role at the organization. If I wasn't the first, probably like in the first like handful, right? There were, and that also meant they didn't have quite like a robust D&I program, right? Yeah. You know, I was like employee, I don't remember, probably in the 120s around there. And, there were a lot of challenges, and I was exhausted, you know, after, I think I was there for a year and a half. I was also in business school full time at this point.
Wow.
Too. So I was a little tired, and I left, but I also left feeling like I had wins, and that I also had direction for where I was going. So I had this realization that even though I was early on, even though I had access to the CEO, it was so hard to get people in the organization behind social impact as a real business strategy, even in a mission-oriented company, right? And I had a hard time having people buy into the idea of centering Black and Brown individuals and communities as a legitimate and valid like business strategy. And I
knew the can you CEO. Share with us like a little bit into the weeds of like what are some tools that you used to make that case that worked and that didn't work? Like an advice for people listening, right? That are similar but different. You were at a B2B role, but like these are D&I mm-hmm. professionals trying to make the business case from an HR perspective. But you also have multicultural marketers that have to fight for those marketing dollars to be allocated. So like what are some lessons there from like your experience that worked at an organization like Headspace and that didn't work?
Well, so I think the first thing was definitely which needed for me necessitated like having the founders be behind it was the reframing of philanthropy into social impact, right? They had a philanthropy program when I came in and we quickly realized it wasn't working, right? It wasn't being as impactful as I think anyone wanted it to be in the organization. And, you know, we did our analysis and we came up with those numbers of, hey, like the strategy is not working. And it's actually failing pretty badly. And so having the data around that was really helpful to be like, we don't want to discard these populations and these groups that we're helping, but we want to make sure that if we're doing something that's actually impactful. So that was the first like step was, here's the data that we have on the program that's already happening. It's not working. Here's presenting it. And now, obviously, they were like, so what then? It's not working. So what now? And the second step was really more of an educational of bringing the term social impact into the organization. And then almost at an MVP level, teaching them what it could look like. So at a small scale, so no resources yet, let us just like try these things. And so what that looked like for me was at working with the UX team, right? Working with the engineering team, working with like every single department that I think had separated themselves from philanthropy, right? Seeing it as just like an afterthought program or an additional program that one person is working on, to being like, hey, when we're looking at design research, who are you interviewing? Who are you using for your customer discovery, right? Who's part of those focus groups? And then how do we bring in more people and expand them so you have more robust data, right? And so we had champions, I think, in every one of those teams, which was really helpful for us, that worked closely with us in kind of carrying out these tiny experiments of demonstrating, hey, this is how we can get additional data that aligns with our social impact and D&I strategies, right? That is actually not going to cost you any additional like money and will get you more robust data that will expand your market. And that was an incredibly important part of what ended up being the social impact strategy, right? Expanding the definition of what it meant and then kind of in small ways showing them this is what it looks like. Engineering was one that was a hard one. They're like, what role do we play? We just build the things, right? And it was like, well, actually, you know, when you're looking at growth hacking or when you're looking at terms that you're buying ads for, et cetera, what words are you looking for? Because those aren't the words that will resonate with the Black community or will resonate with the Latino community, right? They might not be looking up meditation, right? But let me tell you, they might be looking up, you know, Latinos might be looking up like relax, like, or chill, right? How to chill. Like there are different terms that we use when we're like colloquial terms that you may not be inputting into your data set, right? As growth hackers, as engineers, that we can help you with and that align with these strategies and will eventually be better for the business.
I love that because, that is a consistent theme that I see and D&I programs that work versus that don't, which is it's embedded in every part of the company. Number one, with leadership's buy-in, I think that's, to your point, the most important. And two, it's not like this sequestered group of people on the side of the organization. It's something that's truly embedded, right? So like analogous to multicultural marketing, where it's not a separate department, every single department, every single marketing insights is talking about multicultural consumers. To your point, search terms, images, UX, UI, right? Like if we're talking about CPG, what type of recipes? Like the Black community is going to look at very different recipes than the Latino community, than the white community, than Asian community, right? Mm-hmm. Things like that. Like, yeah, I think those are just really great, great takeaways.
Yeah. So it was a battle though. I didn't want to say that. It was not easy, but I think all those small examples and the small, what I call the small MVPs, right, of what we were doing, of bringing focus groups in, nonprofits, right? And we were doing like the heavy lifting, right? It was just two of us of, hey, UX, just give us the questions, right? We're going to do this with this nonprofit. They're going to come into the office and then we're going to give you all the data afterwards, right? We're going to give you the reactions. We're going to give you data. We took that off their hands. And then that became a part of what we did continually to get all of this data from different populations. And that eventually trickled up to our social impact strategy and, you know, the win that was, we're creating a social impact team. We're calling it social impact, not philanthropy. And it's going to work across all of these departments.
Is it still there today?
It is. And they actually now have a chief social impact and diversity officer, I believe. And I don't want to mess it up. I think it's chief social impact and inclusion officer. And it's really cool to see that some of those ideas that we brought, you know, my colleague and I brought in when we first came in that got a little bit of pushback are now being implemented. You know, it took a couple years, but they got there and they're seeing it like as an executive position, right? And getting resources. And I think it's a bigger team now, which is really cool.
That's awesome. So you left Headspace, finished grad school. What happened after that?
Then, like I said, I was a little tired afterwards and I was like, okay, it was still like I had wins, but it was still really hard, even though I was in early. So where can I have the most impact? Right. And I was like, well, I have two options. I can start my own thing, right? Because then I have all the decision-making power. I was like, also a lot of work and a lot of money I don't have. And the second one, as I had been kind of embedded in the investing world at that time, was, well, if I'm an early stage investor, then you can work closely with startups and you can even change the way you look at the criteria for investing in startups, right? At those early stages. And work with them as they grow. And if I'm able to work with them at those stages, then maybe I can influence and help them early on embed these like impact strategies, right? So it's not an afterthought. So it's not, you know, working backwards after you built something. And that's what led me to investing and specifically impact investing. And the place I'm at now has been around for 12 years. So New Media Ventures has been around for 12 years. I think it for me, it aligned very much with what I was doing in my day to day, which was impact work and the investing work, as well as the progressive aspect of it, which, you know, I am on the board of nonprofits here in LA, specifically one that works with incarcerated individuals. I was, you know, I'm part of a lot of little activist groups, pretty engaged in that way. And so it seemed like the perfect place for me to be in, marrying kind of the nonprofit world, for-profit world, investing, tech, all of that. So we're for the listeners out there, New Media Ventures is an early stage seed fund that invests in entrepreneurs who are innovating in the progressive movement. So
that's amazing. Like what type of like companies for us to get a sense of like the type of companies that y'all are investing in?
So we invest across three verticals. And I think something that's interesting for us is we also meet founders where they're at capital-wise, which means that we can make grants and we do for-profit investments. So we invest in advocacy and organizing. A lot of our nonprofit grant making happens there. We invest in media platforms, media tech, media tools, et cetera. And we invest in civic technology. And that includes political technology. It includes technology that can be used for government and other types of public service goods.
That's incredible. I mean, that's like really, I feel like a perfect marriage of your interests, right? In terms of the nonprofit side, advocacy, venture capital, entrepreneurship. Yeah. That's awesome. And you've mentioned before in other, you know, conversations, like, you know, you want to impact the entrepreneur at this stage and kind of look at it differently in terms of metrics. But I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, I mean, you're like, one of your passions is like the racial wealth gap. And I feel like, you know, you believe from a venture capital perspective, that's one way to solve it. Like, tell us more how, I mean, one, maybe there's people that are not familiar with what the racial wealth gap is. And two, like, you know, how you see your career positively affecting that.
Yeah. So this is an area that's evolved for me over time. I think first, to define the racial wealth gap, it's the divide that exists in wealth, which isn't just income, right? So it's like assets, what's inheritances, everything, the assets that are passed down over time, family, you know, individual through individual, et cetera, that like defines your wealth. And there's a gap and a divide that exists, quite drastic one that exists between white families in the United States and Black families. And I don't have the latest numbers, but they're not any better than they were 5 or 10 years ago.
They got worse during the pandemic, yeah, unfortunately.
During the pandemic, which makes sense. And root causes are a lot of the things that we been talking about, right? Education, policies, laws, et cetera, that have existed that have almost disadvantaged and purposely left out certain communities, specifically the Black community and the Latino community. And so that exists, right? And for me, I think I came to a point where I realized, and I think we all come to a point where you realize that, oh, the amount of money and the amount of wealth that you have in the United States really dictates the quality of life and the services that you're able to get. Right, it impacts like the education level from preschool to college and post college. It impacts the quality of healthcare. It impacts just so many services and things that like legitimately affect how long you live, right? How long you live and how happily you live, like your legitimate survival in this country, that it just didn't seem like something that I could ignore. That being said, and Mario, you listened to me say this, you know, in that conversation we were part of a few months ago, you know, I was all bought into the generational wealth, and the solution is we have to amass generational wealth, right? And I think in the past few years, as I've done more like introspection around like my values, as well as, you know, just learned a lot about my heritage even more and our ancestors, I feel like there's a tension for sure between that individual goal and what I actually think will be a solution, right? I feel like a root problem in this country is the way that capitalism operates here, right? Which, you know, I think has been inherently unequal to this point, right? Where it depends on some people having more, other people having less. And I almost feel like if I focus solely on racial wealth and specifically individual wealth, then I'm only perpetuating the same problems and the same issues that got us to where we're at now, right? So it's so individual. I think we like to think that it's a if all Latinos, right? But I think actually what we're doing is we're encouraging individuals to amass wealth, and with the hope that they will give back in some way.
Yeah.
And we'll hire from our communities, etc. No guarantee, just the hope, right? The rationale. But that's currently what we're depending on right now. And that hasn't worked. And something I was thinking about last night in preparation for this was, I almost feel like we've lost some of those like native like values to our heritage, right? Which is community, which is mutual aid, right? So I'm thinking a lot about that, and I know I'm rambling, but I'm thinking a lot about how do we put less attention to individual maximization of wealth, right? That again only furthers the problem we're currently in. It only fixes it for a certain few. And how do we instead refocus our strategies and the way we distribute capital, because we still are in this capitalistic society and we live under the system? How do we redistribute or reframe strategies so that it supports a network of wealth, right? Or even divorces wealth as the primary value in our society. And so I've been thinking a lot about that, and I'm going to open it up.
It's interesting this, I'm grappling with something similar and not that I'm agreeing or disagreeing with you, but like, I feel that same tension within myself as well. But what kicks in, it's like, and so this is specifically getting personal, right? Thinking about my kids' school, right? We're thinking about moving them from a public to a private school. And I guess I'm dealing with that in a similar aspect, right? Am I perpetuating this, right? Like, should I keep them in the public school and advocate, right? Like, I'm really involved. Like, I volunteer every Monday. I go into the computer lab, and I'm proud of that. I'm a male, I'm a father, you know. Yeah. all the volunteers, for whatever reason, tend to be females, tend to be moms, tend to be white moms. And it's like, I'm proud. I'm a Latino male going in there with tattoos, helping little kids with their computer stuff. Right. But you know, my wife and I have been talking, like, we feel like the class is too big and we want to get them into private school. Mm-hmm. And so I'm starting to do research, and I'm seeing, you know, people talk about, well, the best thing to do is like, well, let me back up. One, it's very hard to define what success is or what makes a good school in the public school system. Mm-hmm. Every metric that we talk about, whether it's standardized test scores, the availability of extracurricular activities, class size, really are just proxy for wealth. And so, right, it's not, it has nothing to do with the quality of school. Okay, fine, I get that. But then the other side of me is like, so this is like, for me, right, the first time in my family that I'm able to afford, and in my family, right, to be able to put my kids into private school. So it's like, one side of me, I know that I'm perpetuating this. The other side of me, it's like, why does it have to be on me, right? When me and my people and my family can afford to put our kids in environments like that. So I don't know if that helps the conversation, but that's the tension.
The continual, right, tension of that we're put into, right, of like survival, right?
Yeah.
And what it means in this country right now. And I also, one thought that came up for me is that I think something that I've come to as well is I like nice things, right? I like going on trips and exploring, and I like my nice mattress, right? And it's not about forgoing that, but it's about how am I advocating for everyone to be able to have that, right? And so I don't have the answer for you, but, but I think that sometimes when we're in these spaces, it's almost like, oh, you have to suffer to really be it. And I think it's not about that. It's about intentionally assuring that in whatever we're doing, we're also keeping in mind these other populations that aren't in the spaces that we're in, right? And how are we fighting for them? And how are we making sure that we are including them in the conversations? Because we can't speak for them, right? For other people that whose experiences we don't know. How are we, I think I mentioned this in the other conversation, but how are we I don't know what the articulate way of saying this is, but not continually just like trying to maximize like our own wealth to the point of exploitation. Because I think that's what happens, right? When you're so focused on like maximizing all that you have, your exploitation is part of that in any business. And so how are we continually checking ourselves and checking our community to say, hey, I understand the desire, right, and the pressure to maximize shareholder value, but actually, what's the expense, right? What's the cost of that? Is it we can't raise wages for, we can't give this benefit to these people that would really allow them to be able to be more involved in their school, right? For other parents. I think there are other ways that we can like check ourselves and our community. I think that's the important part of going back to those community values, right? How are we like checking each other and calling each other in as we build our businesses, as we still live in this system, right? While also giving capital to those who are trying to transform the way we even live in the system, because there's like those two, right? We have to resource the people that are trying to reimagine and are working towards building that reimagination while also trying to survive ourselves in the system. And so I think that's where I'm at.
Yeah.
It's a continual conversation, everyday conversation for me.
No, I feel, I mean, and I think both of us come from a research background in a sense. And I think, having a market research company really does ground me, because I'm talking to populations that I'm, you know, now 12 years into my company that I'm not interacting with. Like, I'm, let's be real. But doing work, for example, for LA County Public Health, for vaccines, doing work for, Medi-Cal, looking at that data is super grounding, right? And, you know, thankfully I've built a network of other Latino entrepreneurs and like yourselves here in LA. And I have conversations with them and they'll say things sometimes. And I'm like, yo, like, I don't know, just things about whatever life or, income. And I'm like, dude, like let's say, you know, talking about a salary and saying that how six figures is so little. And I'm like, bro, that's like triple the average household income. So I feel like research has grounded me in some respect where I'm not necessarily forgetting, that like I'm super privileged, I guess. I don't know if that's helpful, but.
You know, I think it's also relevant, right? And obviously you and I both live in Los Angeles and we know what's been happening with the city council and with our, you know, the Latino leaders here. And I think, for me, it was something that always reminds me. I remember hearing, I don't remember, like a few years ago, that there, I don't know if it was a study or if it was just like an anecdote, but someone was saying that as an observation that as Latinos kind of rise up in the ranks of corporate, they tend to disconnect from their community. And which makes sense, right? You're closer to like whiteness, it's safer, right? There's so many perks of it again in the US. And I remember feeling like, oh, I don't want to ever do that. And to your point, I think that sometimes what happens as we do get more income, as we do get more privilege, there is this feeling of like comfort and of safety that we feel. And I feel like what, not to pat myself on the back, but no, what I've done really well, but also because, you know, of where my family stands, I feel like I have been very intentional about, similar to you, like staying grounded in that way, right? Staying grounded in that my experience is actually the exception and not the reality for most people in this country, and especially most like Latinos and Black Americans in this country, and putting myself in uncomfortable situations, going to places that maybe I haven't visited in a long time, right?
Yeah.
And being like, oh, I see, you know, I when I go back home, like sometimes there's been times where I still have to go clean houses with my mom, right? And
yeah,
they don't, the people that are paying my mom to clean their house, they don't care that I graduated from Stanford. And they also don't know, right? They don't know that I have a fancy like title, chief investment officer, right? They just see me as that woman who's been cleaning our houses, like daughter,
right?
Who's helping. And that is a reality check.
Yeah.
A lot of the times. And so I think we have to do a better job at being connected to populations that we maybe don't feel connected to, or that we intentionally removed ourselves from because of comfort, and reminding ourselves that our reality is not reflective of the true reality. But research definitely helps with that, to your point.
Yeah.
Of seeing the numbers, right? To go back to our initial point of like the validation of other people's experiences and being like, whoa, I live completely different. And that's a problem that I didn't know that.
Right. Yeah. No. And I think also qualitative too is so important. Like there's numbers and, you know, quantifying that is super important. I am a quant guy, but listening to people and qualitative settings. So like during the pandemic, we did a lot of video interviews just like this. And hearing the stories, I think, is equally important. Like, you know, getting to know, I mean, what people's day-to-day reality. And that's one thing that I'm advocating within my industry, which is the market research industry, right? Talking about qual. You know, typically qualitative research is like, after work at 6 o'clock, you know, and people show up and it's a focus group. And I'm like, yo, not all populations have a 9 to 5. Mm-hmm. You're asking mothers to come in at 6 o'clock. Many times they don't have childcare. Many times both parents are working. They have two jobs. You got to be more flexible with the times. They're like, oh yeah, parking validation. I'm like, many don't have cars. You have to make sure that you're near like public transportation. So I don't know, things like that. I feel like I've tried to do in the research industry, which, you know, has excluded Black and Brown voices from research. Right. And that hurts the bottom line at the end of the day, right? When companies are making products and services that aren't including, you know, now 50% of the population on them almost, when you look at younger generations, it's like, yeah, what are you doing?
You know, I remember going back to Headspace telling one of the VPs, and this might be real bold, but the business at that time, be like, eventually you're going to run out of white males to market to.
Right.
Like,
right.
And then what are you going to do? And then right. You know, he laughed, but I was being dead serious, right? Like, what are you going to do? Like,
yeah,
you know, you can only have so many of them using your product. And then what if you haven't been preparing for this moment or been inclusive of them then, or even seeing them as valid consumers of your product?
Yeah,
you're not good. There's no longevity here.
It's kind of interesting. I mean, not to bring up a competitor, but I guess it's okay since you don't work for them anymore. It seems like Calm took a different route, right? Like off the bat with LeBron James. I think that's pretty cool. I just realized that they seem to embrace that from the get-go. I don't know how long Calm's been around. Maybe it was around prior to that, but their first big ambassador that I was aware of was LeBron James, and they took the whole performance athlete. But that there is obviously a multicultural marketing aspect to that as well.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, Calm has done a really good job at at expanding beyond just, you know, meditation and whatnot to other audiences. And I think that goes to the value of having people and being able to take risks, right?
Right.
Of being like, we don't know if it's going to work, but try it and let's see what happens.
Yeah.
But definitely thinking that there's value early on.
Well, I could talk to you about this forever. It's been awesome, but we're coming up at the end of our time. Really enjoyed our conversation, learned more about you. That was awesome. And I hope everybody listening found value as well. If people want to connect with you, if they have questions or just want to like stay in touch with what you're doing, what's the best way to follow you online?
Probably LinkedIn. So LinkedIn, I don't know how to do the @in/Salinas1.
Yeah. Do they have handles yet?
They have the URL and it's really weird. It's like linkedin.com/in/JessicaSalinas1 is
okay.
Mine. And then I'm on Twitter as well at jsalinas011.
Awesome. Thanks again for joining. And thank you everybody for listening.
Thanks for having me, Mario.
Thanks to everyone listening in. To get more multicultural insights, check us out at thinknow.com and follow us on social media. You can also subscribe to this podcast on your favorite platform. Final thank you to our producer, Lucas Martinez, who created our intro music and makes our podcast sound great. To email him, reach out to martinez.lucas.a@gmail.com.